Blade Runner, A Korin Tiger's Haiku by Craig Laporte. In 2019, mech rippers with robot snakes. It's the show to see.
What? That felt short for a haiku.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Korin Tigers. Ty, Dan, and Craig here. Welcome to the show, everybody, and Happy New Year. How are you guys doing?
I'm good. Happy New Year, gentlemen.
Happy New Year. Yeah, it's been a while.
New Year.
It's been a minute, right, Craig? That's what you always like to say.
It's been a minute. Yeah, it's been a minute. Yeah.
Just the
pop culture educated Craig Laporte.
I'm hip. I'm cool. Tucka, tucka, tucka.
The Christmas episode was a huge success.
Massive.
Craig was just telling us prior to recording, hundreds of downloads.
Only 4 listens, though. I don't know how that...
No, I don't think we have a jingle for this, but I was listening to it, and I took this note. This is the first note I took for this podcast, and I took it in late December. And so we're going to have a first in a while escalator.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe you gentlemen have escalators as well. I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but... I just wanted to say, I actually do. I said in the Christmas episode that I don't like Amy Grant outside the Christmas album. And I feel like I succumbed to some sort of peer pressure there because you guys were teasing me.
Yeah, because it's Amy Grant, right? So that makes sense.
But I'm going to retract that because I forgot something. I legitimately did forget something absolutely critical. You consider Amy Grant, a song that Craig and I have sang together on various chats hundreds of times. Next time I fall in love with Peter Cetera and Amy Grant.
Oh my God. That's a Hall of Famer.
It's a huge one. It's an out of the park. Next time I fall.
I'll be Amy Grant.
No, just... I know better what to do.
Next time I fall in love.
Yeah. There we go. So clearly, it's cool to love Amy Grant because she can't be 50% of that song and not get cool cred.
So, yeah, no, I'm in.
That's a big retraction on my part and probably one of the biggest mistakes I've made in any of these podcasts. I really felt bad for it.
Well, I have a list if you want to know about previous mistakes. No,
I'm just kidding. Now, I've been told there is an email waiting for us. And before you read it, Craig, I want to know. Because this is going to be a definitive moment. We have social media update and we have G's mail. And I'm going to get rid of one of these two sound buttons. If G's written us an email today, she can keep the segment. If this email is not from G, the segment is, she's disowned it and it's open for whoever else wants to walk in.
I feel like that's a short leash for G, considering she's driven our segments for...
We named a segment after. That ain't free.
I thought it was named after Google.
Oh, it was a play on words.
No, I'm just kidding. The email is absolutely from Giselle.
So it's an email.
All right.
Oh, my God.
Gmail.
So wait a second. Wait a second. Should I put the canary back on the rack? Or how?
Dan.
What do we?
Come on.
Does no one care about the bird anymore? Oh. Jesus.
I understand why people don't listen to us now.
Speaking of dead bits, yeah.
I'm just kidding. G responded to Ty specifically. It's a one sentence email responding to Ty's selection. The first sentence is all in capitals. I love every version of Blade Runner. Great choice.
Wow.
Oh God,
that's
terrible. I threatened to take the segment away. Damn it. Why do I always step on myself in these stupid podcasts? Literally comes up on me 2 seconds after I say it, too.
So, G, fuck. Thanks for your
job, asshole.
Please,
nice job.
Please disregard Ty's disrespect and continue
to
support
the
show.
Giselle. Well, you know, it reminds me, G and I got along, I'd say, very well during our time as co-workers. You might say I was a subordinate, but maybe not.
It could be argued.
I think I know who was managing.
But... But yeah, I kind of, you know, I remember having, I have a terrible memory for certain things, and I just wish there's something I could do about it, but there really isn't. I have big, big blank spots in my memory, and I couldn't tell you if I had to what Giselle and I used to talk about at all. But over the last few podcast episodes, we've come up with the music, like the Alan Allman Pillow Talk stuff. And then I kind of have this vague memory of talking to her about it. And obviously I made her a tape. We never got follow-up on what that tape was, but I'm pretty sure it was Pillow Talk music. And I wasn't hitting on her or anything. I just gave her a mixtape.
yeah, that's not suspicious in any way, really.
Of 80s love ballads to you know my boss.
You know what I just thought of?
Was this around performance review time? Was that one of the
yeah, usually.
Hey, G, I got you this Peter Cetera and Amy Grant song on repeat.
I got a box of mixtapes. It's just for performance reviews.
So what's the message? What are we?
That was it. Dan, I read it.
Oh, right.
She loves I love every version of Blade Runner. Great choice. Ty, you just reminded me of something. Back in that store that we all worked in, one of the highlights of a day at work was when everyone took lunch at the same time. And in the lunchroom, we all watched Jeopardy together. And I felt like that was a big thing at that particular store that a lot of people really enjoyed doing. In the news recently, Canadian Alex Trebek has passed, and that just made me think about that. And I'm sure we have an RIP lined up for later, but on the spot here, I'm just coming up with this. I want to throw out this episode's RIP to the late, great Alex Trebek.
Okay, I'm willing to do that. An actor in this movie is dead, but let's give it to Alex Trebek. I actually saw Ken Jennings hosting an episode of Jeopardy, I want to say yesterday.
Yeah.
And I think was doing a really great job. And I wouldn't say Alex Trebek was in the role for fun purposes. And Ken Jennings wasn't doing that either. So I think they should just make Ken Jennings permanent host of Jeopardy, because I think he was doing the job that Alex would want him to have done.
I wasn't super into the series for the Ken stuff. Do I have this right that he was adopted by Alex Trebek? Is that what happened?
No. They just went on a lot of long, suspicious walks.
For ice cream, no doubt. There's nothing wrong with that, by the way.
On the beach, yeah.
We should definitely tell the retail location that we all worked at ice cream story on this podcast at least once.
That's a winner. I was the only one. Did you fall for it, Ty? Or was I the only one who sniffed it out immediately?
Oh, I orchestrated it.
Yeah, Ty crafted it.
Okay.
He was pulling the strings.
And then I took it to a level that was just beyond ridiculous at the end.
Well, let's go. We're here. Let's go.
Well,
I mean, should that be maybe a bonus at the end? Because we do have a podcast to talk about.
Sure. Maybe if our last episode, when quarantine is all over.
Oh, there you go.
I'll tell the story.
I'm sure we'll be building material for quite a while, if that's the
case. Okay, so, gentlemen, we all watched Blade Runner in the last few weeks.
That was the 2049? Is that what we watched? Blade Runner 2049?
So this was the 1982 film, Blade Runner. However, we watched, and stop me here, there's several versions of the film, as G has alluded to there. We all watched Final Cut?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I watched Final Cut.
Yeah. I looked into the other versions again before I watched Final Cut again, and I forgot that I own like the full 4K HDR version of this on my Google account, so I just watched that because I never seen it yet with all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And Google upgraded that movie for me for free from an old digital copy I owned, which
what
is a weird
bunch
thing for them to
of
do.
Sweethearts.
Yeah, well, it's real nice of Google to do that. I think they just didn't want both copies on their server for no reason.
Probably.
So we all watched Final Cut. You know what's weird? I do not care for the Why I Picked It audio drop. I've gone to press it 3 times in the last 10 seconds, and I just couldn't bring myself to do it.
Hey, Ty, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you pick this movie?
Why I picked it. It's got all the staples of a great drop. It's got the explosion.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just wasn't feeling it there. But I love this movie. The first time I saw it would have been the 1992 director's cut on DVD in my father's new toy at the time, the RCA DVD player. Ooh. I did a lot of back looking into the time. I even looked up the specific RCA DVD player that my dad owned. And I can isolate I believe I saw this movie for the first time in 97.
Okay.
So I picked this disc, and I don't know why I picked it, because my parents, my father was like, you know, pick a DVD you want to watch. And I grabbed this, and I don't know why, but what, looking into it a little bit further, I think I was aware that Blade Runner was an influence on a ton of the stuff that I was seeing in the late 90s, but I had known that I hadn't seen the movie itself. So cyberpunk or neo-noir film, all that kind of stuff in the late 90s was a huge thing. Blade Runner's influence can be seen in everything in the late 90s that I was into, from like PlayStation marketing, Wipeout, Psygnosis Games, Deus Ex, to like The Matrix, 13th Floor, movies like that. And I just remembered, you know, from my first viewing, I don't even know if I followed the plot, but I love the aesthetic of it, and I like the monologue at the end. I remember hitting me hard, even though I wasn't really too fully in on what the context of it was, I don't think, at the time. But it's just one of those movies that always stuck with me, and I watch it maybe, oh, I don't know, every 5 or 6 years I end up seeing it. And every time I see it, I get more out of it than the last time I watched it. A movie for me to get into it, it's really important that the setting and the environment and the world feels real. And if you can get that, especially in a sci-fi movie, then I'm into it and I'm paying attention. And then if the rest of the movie is good, then you've got a winner for me. And that's just how I describe Blade Runner, I think.
It's funny for me, as soon as this world kind of opened up, I was like, I totally get why Ty likes this, because based on my knowledge of what you like for some other movies, and specifically how deep you just dove into another cyberpunk 2077 in the game, my limited exposure to that, I was like, man, this has a lot of that feel in that cyberpunky world that I know that just kind of scratches you in the right spot and you really dig it. And
so those who might not know that Cyberpunk 2077 also just came out, it's been in the news a little bit because it came out a little bit buggy, but I felt that this was a topical movie for that reason, because that industry is much larger than a lot of people assume it is. It's mm-hmm. the number one entertainment industry in terms of dollars. And the biggest game in December is Cyberpunk 2077. And a lot of this world and aesthetic is in the same exact category. And Blade Runner, in terms of visual, I think, identity, just sort of pioneered all of this. There was a sort of comic series being written around the same time. It was being written parallel to Blade Runner that came out after Blade Runner. The name, I wrote this down, but I forget it. But there was a parallel sort of comic series that came out at the same time that also had a similar aesthetic. But it's funny that both of those things I looked into weren't really appreciated at the time they came out. This movie released and wasn't received well. The studio botched the cuts of it. But before we get into the different versions and the aesthetic and the world building, I just want your guys' first impressions on the film when you watched it. If it was the first time, and what you thought when you watched it.
Sure. Yeah. The very first time I saw this film was last night. I'd never seen it before. It had been on my radar for years. And to be fair, I remember as a kid having a sizable VHS, having access through, I think it was my mom's boyfriend at the time, a sizable VHS library of
tons of amazing action. Was he the one that bought you cigarettes and stuff too?
Action. Yeah, that's the guy. He did.
Brent? No, is his name Brent?
Brent. no, it was Roy. No, it was Gary. No, anyway, he had a sizable library of VHS cassettes, and I remember wanting to watch The Running Man and accidentally grabbing Blade Runner and popping it in and getting a few minutes into it and just being like, oh, this looks kind of cool. Like, oh, maybe I'll give this a shot. But then I immediately found Running Man and watched The Running Man, which that's at the age that I was, which was like 12 to 13, I was just going for a known entity at that point. I wasn't willing to sit down and do something new. And I was like, oh, what is that Blade Runner? Maybe I'll go back and watch it sometime. And then I just forgot about it for 30 years until Ty brought it up in December. I did enjoy the movie. I can see its influence, and I realize that a lot of the things that it does, I take for granted as 80s movie themes and structure that I can realize that it was the pioneer of in watching mm-hmm. it, because they didn't exist before it did it. And kind of that video gamey, here's your four bosses, let's go one at a time and chip through them until we beat the final boss at the end you know, approach to these, what are they called? The mechs, the replicants. Very cool world. Very well shot. I love the way that society is kind of smushed together in this weird German, Asian, American, strange world that they've created. I liked everything about it, and we're going to talk about it for the next little while, so I'll just shut up now and let Dan go.
Well, I think we all appreciate that, Craig. Thank you very much. I thought, you know, I guess the and I know this isn't the discussion part yet, but I take issue with the idea that there's a lot of 80s movie stuff in here. When I see this, I do not see an 80s movie at all. I truly don't. Like,
really?
I thought it was terrific. Not to say the 80s movies can't be good, but, you know, just if I think of an 80s movie, this is not
a compliment.
Yeah.
I kind of see where you're going with that. I if somebody said to me, watch this movie and then tell me what decade it was made in,
that'd be a tough one, man.
It wouldn't be easy, really? But I believe I'd land on 80s, but it's a tough call. Even if I went 80s and then you asked me to say what specific year, I would have said like 89. Like, I would have gone late 80s. It blows me away that this movie is 82.
Yeah.
And I was so 2 years old when this movie was made. That every time I watch this, I think of that and I go, you know, nuts that this movie is almost 40 years old.
I did play that game in my head as I was watching it, because I was like, oh, I knew it was an 80s movie. I don't know how I knew, but I did. And I tried to place it. And in my head, I thought at first it was like 84. And then I was like, no, 87. It's got to be 87. So I did that same thing, because I always try to include the year of the movie that it was made on my note, because I put that on the show title when I post it online. So I had to specifically look up that info, and I was really impressed. And that's when I kind of came to that realization that this was a very trend-setting movie, and it's a lot of its structure pieces and the way its story was told were duplicated in other movies that I enjoyed from the 80s.
And certain aesthetics in film and in the 80s and the 90s and the 70s, any decade really, that were pioneered in those decades died quickly because they were dated super quickly. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, if you watch Miami Vice, you know, it's of the time. And so everybody's clothes they have on are dated, like right out of the gate. You're like, oh my God.
Yeah, like to the month.
Right. But the cyberpunk aesthetic, and even the, you know, there's certain things like Tyrell's glasses that he's wearing and certain things like that, where you're going, well, okay, obviously this might not be 90s, because no one would wear glasses that big. certainly no man would. But that cyberpunk aesthetic lived on in video games and movies and even to today, obviously, with the big release that just came out. So that didn't date itself quite as badly. And that look is in Star Wars, out of necessity when it was filmed in the 70s and 80s, but for nostalgia when it's filmed in 2019 or whatever. So that part of it doesn't date it at all. It's just kind of maybe the clothes or the audio, or
you know what though? I mean,
there's no CG in it at all.
The clothes, like the clothes and the Asian elements to it, because it's not tied to a time, it's like you can't pin it down, and the Asian stuff is ageless, right? Like, you're never going to say that's out of date or out of fashion, because it's been here for 3,000 fucking years. So I it looked so good, and Ridley Scott did such a good job with it that it looks clean and crisp, and the there's so much texture. Like, everything is wet in like half the scenes. Everything's fucking wet. It's unbelievable, and it just – it I don't know. It just works. It's I thought it was terrific.
This is – Ridley Scott, I have such a love-hate relationship with him. I'm glad you brought it up. We'll kind of part. We're sort of transitioning into talking about the different versions and Ridley Scott specifically here. But he is masterful, I think, at creating these places you want to spend time in these movies, even if they're dark, even if they're they just feel real and like they have elements of them. What he got sort of worse at later, I think, when he started into Prometheus and Alien Covenant and that kind of stuff, was there wasn't this need to explain everything. And there's so much in Blade Runner that's unanswered questions. And Villeneuve, who's the director for 2049, the sequel that came out a few years back, which is also an excellent movie. He's also doing the Dune remake, which is another one of these. That's a late 70s film that isn't easily dated beyond the dry hairstyles and the stuff like that. But he's good at making these worlds, and the necessity to explain every little detail if you bring something up, you have to close it off. That wasn't there in him back then, it seems like. And those are why all of his best stuff is back then and not more recently. Because
I think
he can still make a beautiful... Prometheus is a beautiful film.
Yeah.
But the problem with it is that he sort of gave in to these demands of closing off every little thing that he opens, whereas this film doesn't have that in it at all.
Yeah, I like that in this film there was even parts that like were key story elements that they didn't even bother explaining for until well into the movie, like when he found the scale and was going to eventually tie it back to the snake. I was just like, okay, what the hell is this thing? He found it and then he just shoves it in his pocket for three quarters of the movie. You know, and then eventually gets around to it, but they didn't spend too much time like him talking to 42 people like, oh, I found this. What could it be? Oh, it's a scale. We better investigate. And like, they just kind of let the story progress at its own pace.
And I think going back to your point, Ty, about kind of having to explain everything, I think it doesn't have to be explained. It has to fit together. So if somebody asks, you could give an answer. Like, I think the thought has to be put into it to say that this is how these things go together.
Right.
But yeah, I don't want to see an explanation for everything.
Right. But there was points in this movie, a couple off the top of my head. First thing I'll say is the 1982 version of this film, there was a work print that didn't test well. They did the studio did testing and it was unreleased. So we'll never see that version. But as a result of how that version of it did in the studio's research, the theatrical version, which is 117 minutes, was narrated by Harrison Ford and has a happy ending at the end where you see a little bit more.
Is that a hand job joke?
Yeah, in the elevator on the way down.
Rachel, you dirty girl.
Yeah, so that version of it, I have seen that version. I sought it out probably a decade and a half ago, and I watched it. And it sucks.
Deploy sure lubricant.
It's terrible. Him talking over the thing, it's just a mess. And it's kind of... And it's funny that wasn't Ridley Scott's intention and that he was forced to do that. Whereas now I think if he made that movie today, he seems to be the guy that would be okay with the narration over it. But anyway, that version's terrible. It's not worth watching. The 1992 director's cut is the version I first saw where they took the narration out, but it was largely the same. It's 116 minutes, so there's a minute short there. Because I believe the happy ending is also removed. But then the final...
Wait, is that a joke or the actual happy ending? I don't... I can't even pull them apart anymore.
I've been Googling this the whole time we've been talking. I can't find Blade Runner happy ending anywhere.
Well...
Hey, well, you know what, Ty? I think we may have found a good spot for the Book of Dan here, because you had mentioned that, you know, they had a hard time kind of putting together
the
right picture.
I'm so sorry, Dan. I would have mentioned you earlier.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
Well, do you want to do jingle or jingle-less for this?
I love the jingle. Give me the jingle.
Book of Dan.
Ty, are you turning on all your own drops here? Because that's the second one where you're like, oh, I'm not feeling it.
I've got Ridley Scott syndrome.
These are
you create
babies.
Something, and if you give yourself enough time, you'll start picking at it, and you realize, you won't like anything that you've done. That's why you just got to stick to the release date and put it out.
So I don't pay too much attention to my kids.
You don't want to overinvest.
I'm just kidding.
They're released. You're not going to dwell on it. They're out in the wild now.
So
sorry, Dan. Yes, go ahead.
So no. So Ty, you had mentioned that they had a hard time kind of maybe crafting it or editing it and put it together, and that the studio even kind of did a shitty job pitching it and putting it out into the world. And I actually managed to find a trailer, like a voiceover script from before it actually came out. Like, that was an actual trailer script. So this is from like the summer of 81 or something like that. So I can't actually take credit for this, but I'd like to just kind of give it a go here. The weird part is because, like, again, like Ty had mentioned, they really didn't know exactly the spin to put on it. This is almost like it's like a rom-com sort of thing, which is really, really
strange. I feel this is going to be a bit, but go on.
No, not at all. But so I am, because it is supposed to be like a rom-com sort of trailer, I'm going to try to get myself into that space,
Dan is available for acting.
For voiceover voice work, yeah.
We haven't mentioned it in several
pods. Somebody, as an aside, I actually had somebody reach out to me to do like a podcast thing the other day, and she introduced me first as a voiceover actor, and I said, well, hang on. I've got a long list before we
before you make it, buddy.
His That's only right. voiceover work at that point was interrupting her to stop
so
her.
So for anyone who is out there looking for voiceover talent right now, just open a blank email.
Yep.
Put in the tooth line, thecorntigers@gmail.com.
There you go.
Now, and then make a judgment call based on what you're about to hear. If it's worth sending out for the deets, we'll get them to you. If it's not, you can just close it. Go ahead, Dan.
All right. Thank you very much. Here we go. Detective Rick Deckard's new assignment has put him into a heap of hot water. He's been assigned to find four characters causing a ruckus all over Los Angeles. Lucky for him, it doesn't take long before he meets the woman of his dreams. Rachel is good looking, but she's also a little shy. Well, maybe aloof is more like it. She's also the personal assistant to Dr. T, the millionaire wacky scientist. Before long, Deckard is head over heels for this woman who, by all measures, seems to have a lifelike texture and temperature. And even if she doesn't, Rick Deckard doesn't seem to mind one bit. Which makes us all wonder, just how many robots has Detective Deckard tried to bang? Mothers, lock up your toasters. From the director that brought you Chanel No. 5, The Swimming Pool, this summer, check out Blade Runner, the droid who shagged me.
Wow, mothers, lock up your toasters.
Yeah.
That line is gorgeous.
Yeah, you never know. So he did. He did also, and I want to be clear. This is the reason.
Fresh.
I'm confident that this is historically accurate. It's because prior to this, he did direct the Chanel No. 5, the swimming pool short video. So that's a
fact. I'll have to look that up. Really, Scott, such a twisted past, that man. Well, we watched. Thank you for that, Dan.
Yeah, no. So obviously, the rom-com approach didn't work because whatever they did for this one was great. I guess is what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, you watched a different cut, I think.
Mine was uncut.
Oh, speaking of, in my notes, I've used the term foreskin jobs. I don't know if the hyphen is between fore and skin or skin and jobs. So if there's you guys can clear that
I think there's
for
a
me.
Comma somewhere.
There's a comma. Okay.
There's a comma jobs. All over the place.
Foreskin. There's commas everywhere.
Skin jobs. Not my favorite.
Four of them, Ty. You have to say the whole thing.
I think that was a choice. I think that actor made that choice in the moment and said, you know what, I'm just going to go with skin jobs.
That is one of the points in the world, though, that I think is great that they don't explain. At first, you're kind of thinking these are robots. Then you realize there's DNA involved, and you're never quite sure what they are. They're definitely parts of them, at least that are grown, because you meet the Asian eye grower guy who lives in a freezer.
He only grows Asian eyes. It's unbelievable.
He say you Braid Runner.
Braid Runner.
So it is a little 80s, I guess. I'll give you that.
Gluten free.
Oh boy.
What? Yeah,
only because I can say it without context. I just want to point out that I couldn't use the word flutterboard, but this is okay.
Well,
without context, you certainly were. I'm not going to bleep that out.
We haven't had the post recording discussion yet.
You never know what's going to get bleeped until you hear it.
Maybe if I said flutterboard, it would have been okay.
I think we're getting further away from whatever okay might be.
It depends on what the context is.
There's no context. It's just getting further away.
Oh, God.
So,
damn it.
Just a brief, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen this movie, I couldn't imagine why you would do that. But if you're doing that.
They're already a half an hour in. I mean, they're either here or they're not.
Yeah. The movie opens. If you're not, to me, if you're not hooked when this movie is opening, I don't know what, you don't have a pulse as far as I'm concerned. Because this is the coolest intro of a movie I think I've ever seen. It just opens with the brief explanation of the, with some great music by Vangelis, that's part of this world building. This is the man responsible for Chariots of Fire. Thank you.
Vangelis?
Anyway, yes, he did the entire soundtrack.
Okay, nice.
Which I just love. I have it on vinyl, and I bought it on vinyl because there's three frames above my TV that are designed for records. And I've got the soundtrack for Twin Peaks, the soundtrack to Miami Vice, and the soundtrack
and Raffy Christmas. Oh, damn it.
No, you didn't guess it. It's Blade Runner.
Okay.
I just thought that was a cool thing to do on top of my TV. It's three of some of my favorite TV shows or movies. And Blade Runner made that list, and the soundtrack is awesome. And done by the Chariots of Fire guy, the whole thing. Nice. From start, from front to back, the entire, everything you heard in that movie was him.
One thing I really liked at the beginning of this movie was a jarring thing for me, to take one step back, was looking at the exteriors in this, right? Like the outside world. It's always very dark. Like Dan said, it's always very wet and slick and clearly futuristic. And for me, though, and sorry, Ty, you're going to be upset by this. I don't want to say ruined it for me because that's too strong, but every time they went to interiors, I was just like, okay, it's the 80s. Like, I just felt like I knew right away. And I know that kind of counters what you guys were saying earlier. But what I was going to say was their selection for corporate logos that were going to survive into the future, I started to keep track of what were good predictions and what were bad predictions. And the best prediction they made was Coca-Cola. And I think every other corporate logo they had, they had Pan Am, the airline, which was defunct in 1991. They literally couldn't have picked a worse airline. It was gone the soonest out of any of them after this movie was released. Go ahead.
Now, here's something that you'll love. 2049 Blade Runner, which please watch it if you have it some time.
Sure.
It's a great sequel. They just ran with that.
Oh, Pan Am still
Pan Am ad. Yep. There's an Atari ad.
Good for
and
them.
It's a huge, yeah, it kicks ass. It's the greatest feeling in the world watching 2049 with all of those logos, but like with a kind of edgier aesthetic to it, because this movie takes place 2019.
Well,
what? Fictional 2019. The sequel takes place in fictional 2049.
I don't think this is dystopian. I think this is like a different universe. Well, it's obviously dystopian, but I don't think that they ever thought that this was like 40 years. Hell, we're going to be living like this and that. Like, it doesn't make sense.
I disagree.
You disagree.
The inclusion. Well, you can't do that. You can't triple stamp a double stamp.
I'm pretty sure I can.
I think only because, well, maybe not only, but mainly because of the inclusion of these things, specifically these corporate logos, as the tie back to current times. Like, otherwise, why include them? Why not make up, companies or corporations or whatever and advertise those? Yes, they're familiar because they're from our world, Dan. Unless you're saying that TWA is alive and well in another universe, then
it's a parallel universe. There's all sorts of stuff that's there's a Craig LaPorte in some other parallel universe, and he's also a belligerent asshole. It's a sheer coincidence.
There may be a nice one too, isn't
it? Well, it could be. It's possible, right? Not. There's infinite universes.
Probably not.
Infinite possibilities.
Infinite monkeys. Typewriters.
Yeah. Oh, I love that.
Anyway, it all builds the world. It's kind of unique in a movie in the early 80s to be in the future, but throwing brand names all over the place. I wonder what it took for them to do that back then, because it's not something I think you'd see in science fiction at the time. Very often prior to that.
I'd be interested to know too, did they get a kickback for that the way you would in current day Hollywood, or even like into the 90s, it turned into a product placement game, right? Like, be like, hey, you want a sponsor? We'll put your name on the building in the movie in the future. I feel like this was before that, and these guys just did it as, like you're saying, a proper part of legitimate world building. It wasn't meant to help, pay the best boy grip.
Another key part in the world building that I thought was interesting, and this was a lot to do with the character Gaff, was this idea of city speak. And this is something that I always sort of wondered about, but never really looked into deeply until reading about the movie for this podcast, was that they actually loosely created a mix of languages as sort of city, inner city slang that a lot of these people used. And again, that's something that wasn't explicitly stated in the movie. City speak is referred to in the narrated version I read. So there's a little Harrison Ford blurb talking about the language that Gaff is speaking. But again, it's better, obviously, in the final cut where it's not mentioned at all and you're just sort of hearing it in the background. And if you have sort of a peripheral knowledge of certain languages, you understand some of it, which is super, super interesting to have in a movie like that.
There is online a translation of that first conversation around 9 minutes.
I never saw that.
It's on, I know we've disowned them, but IMDb, under their trivia, someone has gone through who speaks those languages and done their best to translate the, you know, the actual language portions of it where it makes sense to form a sentence to put it in English. I suggest, you know, if anyone's interested, you can check that out on imdb.com.
So the line that Deckard does give in the narrated version is, "That gibber she talked was city speak, gutter talk, a mishmash of Japanese, Spanish, German, what have you. I really didn't need a translator. I knew the lingo. Every good cop did. But I wasn't going to make it easier for him." So it was being, he was pretending not to understand what was being said. Ah. That was the line that was given by Harrison Ford in the narrated.
You know what's interesting? City speak. In that scene, as he's ordering the stuff, like he's trying to order from the guy behind the counter and he's really having a difficult time like clarifying what he's ordering. And then when Gaff comes up over his shoulder and starts his jibber jabber, he calls the same guy over he couldn't communicate to 2 minutes ago and like points over his shoulder like, "What's this guy want?"
I thought it was bizarre that it almost seemed like the guy was telling him, "No, you can't have four. You can only have two."
Yeah.
And in the,
she was rationing the food.
Yeah. In the subtitles too, I turned them on specifically at this point because I was like, "Oh, maybe they'll say what this guy is saying." And to go back to your point where they don't explain everything in this movie, they just let it sit on its own. It just said speaking foreign language. They did not add subtitles.
That's what it said.
Yeah. That's cool.
So I only found out about city speak by reading up on the movie after I was finished watching it. And, you know, those two things don't quite match up. He wasn't speaking a foreign language. He was speaking the language of that city. It was just, and you're saying like, even in another version, he's saying he understands it, but he's trying not to be, you know, too cooperative and give the guy a hard time. Like those three things distinctly change that character in a way.
They do, don't they?
Right? Like yeah, it's such an odd thing.
I want to make one more point about world building that I thought was amazing. They talk about there's some additional that I have never read, additional lore written in novels and so on about what's going on off world. They mention this several times, and this is sort of supposedly the initial need for sort of slave labor in the form of artificial people is what's going on off world. There's sort of this environment where, you know, people are leaving Earth. Earth is obviously not in the best shape it's ever been in. Los Angeles looks pretty much the same, but they do
less homeless people today, though, which is nice.
Yeah. Well, it does seem like there's a population issue. Most noticeably, when they go to the genetic engineer's apartment, the entire building is empty.
Except for him. Yep.
Except, yeah. So there seems to be a surplus of space available for people in terms of living arrangements. And then Deckard has a nice big place too, but he doesn't seem to be working at the time he's recruited. He used to be a Blade Runner. He isn't anymore. And so it just sort of seems, and then the headquarters for Tyrell Corporation is this awesome architecture, really cool pyramid-like futuristic looking building. The work done on all the exterior models, which were all hand-built and then combined with matte paintings and things, is incredible. And frankly, there's only one scene to me, even in the 4K HDR best version I could find, there's only one scene where they zoom in on the first initial intro to the movie into where the void comp test is being administered by the Blade Runner that's killed, or sorry, not killed, injured. Test being administered to Leon.
Hold on, he wasn't killed?
No, it says he's on a ventilator or something.
Oh, right. Yeah, they do say that. You're right.
They zoom in so you can see the interior of the building from the exterior. And you're sort of focused on the interior at that exact moment. But if you take a look at the exterior around the windows, you can tell it's a model. But every other scene, the actual buildings, to me, look very as close to real as you're going to get. I think they outdo CGI in a lot of ways. You can tell where matte paintings are in a lot of spots behind the buildings if you're looking. Mm. But what amazing work done in 1982 by these guys. Mm-hmm. It's freaking incredible. For sure. Yeah. But they've fixed the sort of the old, I think they're called rotoscoping when they overlay different things on top of each other. There used to be some sort of squared off artifacts on top of objects that were moving over top of other objects. But that, all that's gone in the final cut. You can't see any of it. So, which is a great use of CG. So good.
Yeah. Yeah. No, is it just me or did I hear at one point speculation? Like I had seen this movie a long time ago, but it never really sunk in and maybe I wasn't paying close enough attention to it. But wasn't there a debate at some point about whether Deckard was a replicant or not?
Yeah, let's move into that because
I am not prepared. What?
Really? This is awesome. No, I like this because I was curious if either of you guys were going to pick up on this.
So I had heard of this and I approached the movie with that in my mind and I watched the whole movie and I thought, so I've made a decision whether I think he is or isn't.
I'm having scenes flash in my head here in real time where I'm like, okay, like he challenged Rachel on her memories and because her memories were based on a picture. He's got a piano littered with photographs. Mm-hmm. Were those real? Is this kind of where this all this stuff is?
I don't know. Ty, tell us the story.
Yeah, right? Let's do it.
Well, the movie, we got Deckard, who's a former Blade Runner.
Played by Harrison Ford, in case nobody knew.
Played by Harrison Ford. Yeah. And the Blade Runner's jobs are to eliminate marked for death Nexus 6 versions of these androids that are off the rails.
It's kind of
they have a four-year natural lifespan. They're the first of their kind that are difficult to tell between whether or not they're a human or a robot. I don't even want to use the term robot.
Let me touch on this temporarily because this is one of the most upsetting things about this entire universe is that human beings needed slave labor, right? Mm-hmm. So we made robots, but that wasn't good enough. We had to make them feel feelings.
Yeah, like, you know what's crazy about that?
We're going to send you off to do slave labor, but we want to make sure you're fucking sad while you're doing it.
So I thought about this for quite a bit and I got myself to the point where I could see exactly why they do something like this. Because if you look at it as they have
the pleasure models itself requires. Thank you.
But if you look at the machines in the universe, they've got the flying car, right? Well, they've got the Lexmark photo machine that lets you take a photo and
enhance.
Basically look at it in 3D space, which is a really cool, you know, little scene.
Ridiculous.
You never see something that could do the job of a person as a robot. It's not like some of these other sci-fis where, like we were talking about stupid Tech War, where you've got, you know, the robot exact clone of a person, but then you also have everything else in between, right? And so you could come out with a situation where they just can't make an articulate robot with intelligence to do whatever they need to be done off world. But a human could do it. But then there's the two problems of there's probably no humans that want to do it. There doesn't seem to be enough people around and it's dangerous.
Well, I think they're the ones who use the term slave labor. That's in the
it's obviously a dark place, this place. They've got other issues, but you know, they're growing people to send off and do the dirty work, right? And then they're putting 4-year artificial lifespans on them so that if they become a problem and they leave, they're dead. I mean, that's a security measure, right? They eventually just die. But once these four or six originally and turns into four break through to Earth, they want them gone. So that's what these guys are for. These Blade Runners are to wipe these guys out. And because there's either no work left or because Deckard doesn't want to do it anymore. And it sort of seems like the latter because he's sort of forced into it to go back into it. he's not really working anymore. So it doesn't happen often now, but there's these four Stray Nexus 6 guys and they need to be taken care of. And so Deckard is recruited to do that. This story seems simple because there's not a ton of dialogue in it. But there's so much for interpretation that you, I mean, it forces itself to be complicated in your mind with, because you're asking so many questions to be answered. And the most famous one, as Dan said, is Deckard a replicant? And the reason why that's asked, there's a couple reasons. I think the oldest reason is there's a scene with Rachel in the apartment. I don't know if you guys noticed this, but there was an eye trick they were doing, a camera trick for the eyes, where
they give them like
there
a
was
flare.
Sort of a, yeah. Is that what it's called?
Well, I don't know, but it gives it like a brownish sort of glow almost. Like
when you take a picture of a dog, it happens all the time. Yeah. You know, when you see that sort of that, you know, that flash in the back of the eye that's being picked up on with the lens. Mm-hmm. They were intentionally doing that to characters in the movie. Every single one of them replicants. So you can see it in Rachel's eyes.
Yeah.
You can see it in the eyes of all four Nexus 6 guys. But there's a scene with both Deckard and Rachel. And Deckard is behind her, out of focus. And because I think it's because they're doing the camera trick, it kind of, you can see that his eyes are doing the same thing. But he's so out of focus and it's so faint that I would say that it wasn't put there intentionally. But a lot of people that believe Deckard is a replicant think that it was put there. Now, here's something you'll find fascinating. In interviews post-film, Ridley Scott says that Deckard is a replicant.
What?
And Harrison Ford says that he's not.
Ruh-roh. So,
as you can imagine, the internet is not a fan of that kind of contradictory statement.
Here's the thing. I 100% believe Harrison Ford because I've heard him talk about Star Wars to people and just be like, you guys are fucking idiots. He's, you know what I mean? He's like,
but so I left.
He's so
unfortunately
brutal.
Though. Now Dan's hasn't let out what he thinks yet, but before he does, I'm going to say that I don't like him being a replicant and I choose to sort of take the, he's not a replicant side. However, I cannot explain the best evidence for the Deckard as a replicant theory, which is at the piano with the photos, prior to him looking at the picture and finding the snake scale evidence and pursuing that a replicant, he's having a daydream, it seems, of a unicorn. Mm. It's very weird. This is not in this form in earlier versions of the movie either, but it's a, he's having a vision, a daydream of a unicorn in a forest. Just they stuck a horn on this horse, and he just runs by the camera, and then he sort of snaps out of it and starts looking at the photo. And at the end of the movie, what does he find on the floor before he leaves in the elevator with Rachel? Do you remember, Greg?
Yeah, he finds the little origami unicorn.
Unicorn.
Right, and who makes the origami?
Gaff.
Right. So it implies that the unicorn is somehow an implanted memory.
Wow, we don't know that.
Oh, wait, no, that's the best
that's
evidence.
That's the implication.
Because obvious, there's no, and I believe me, I'm the Deckard is not a replicant camp. However, there's no real explanation. Why would Gaff has a knowledge of the implanted memory that just the exact same way that Deckard has a knowledge of Rachel's memory.
Oh, we don't know that he has a memory, or we don't know that Gaff knows about Deckard's memories, because he does those little figures all over the place, right? That was his third. I think he's got like a dodo bird type thing. He's got a little dude, and then he does that one, right?
It's just, look, it's clearly like it's open-ended, and that's what's beautiful about it, because you can interpret the film however you want. And in 2049, the sequel, which it's no secret Harrison Ford is in that movie either.
Boom, not a replicant.
Spoiler alert.
If he is a replicant, you know, he's clearly lasted longer than 4 years, number one. But number two, it's not really talked about beyond that.
But number three, he's also would have to be a much older generation replicant.
Yeah,
which
it doesn't work.
Did not have nearly the same capabilities as these new Nexus 6 guys, which, you know what I mean?
Well,
and he has these
a great argument.
Other people.
You're right, because but here's the thing. Believe me, I've spent 3 hours reading about this over the last month. There is a entire phase that we're sort of missing here prior to the Nexus 6s being retired en masse on Earth, where there was Nexus 6. The Nexus 6s are new, but they're being used off-world at this point. We know they're the newest type officially. I read something online, although I don't... Rachel is implied to be a later model, so they say she's a 7. And then, because he can't hit her as well with the Voight Comp test.
Yeah, she says and that.
Yeah, so she is, there's something about her that's newer than the 6s. So
I like that she also asks him if he's ever taken the test.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's yeah. There's a can lot you, of stuff in there.
Can and you pass it? Yeah.
Because they show so many close-ups of his face and the eye shine is not there. And because, you know, I can't explain the unicorn thing, but the beauty of a movie that doesn't explain everything is you can write off something that you don't particularly like if you don't like that. You know, I prefer to think he's not one. Mm-hmm. But, and there's evidence to support both ways of thinking of that. And they were careful not to wreck that in the sequel, which I think was a super smart move. It's why I'm really excited that this guy is directing the Dune remake, because I love Dune as well. And I have faith that if there's somebody who's not going to wreck it, it might be him, because he did a really good job on the sequel. But Dan, what were you thinking when you went through the film on this topic?
Yeah, I had thought through and kind of what Craig had mentioned earlier, that the fact that Rachel is a he would have to be a previous model, given that, and I didn't know Rachel was a 7. That kind of makes sense. I thought she was just like a prototype that Tyrell.
Yeah, Tyrell.
I'd call Rachel an 8.5.
that Tyrell had put together, and I thought, well, if Tyrell is the man who knows all this shit, and he's gonna got like Rachel as his little pet project, and she's got implanted memories, what are the odds that just a Blade Runner out there has all these bells and whistles on the newest model that's just like not even available on the store shelves, you know? So it just didn't make sense to me from that perspective. Mm-hmm. But you know, I'm not that smart.
I just think, just to counterpoint it, I think there's a way that he can be, that Deckard could be a 6 just without the lifespan.
But he's not super strong on him. Like,
but again, he's got an established history in this universe. He is a retired Blade Runner, unless you're saying like that could be an implanted memory too.
No, I think that they put him in service. Here's the thing, and this gets fleshed out maybe a little more in the sequel too, but the idea of implanted memories here, some of the problem with the Nexus 6s are the memories they implanted. So Rachel's got the memories of Tyrell's niece. The Nexus 6 line that are four-year lifespan and out there working in space, it doesn't seem like as much care was put into the memories that were implanted into them, because they're emotionally immature. They're really struggling with their existence. And I suppose anyone would, but you could sort of tell the main, they call him a villain in this, but Roy, the leader of the four that are alive that Deckard is hunting. He's this really bizarre cross between an adult and a child, and he's struggling with what his existence means. And you see a short arc with him over, and eventually what I think is great about this movie, the theme of it is Roy, in a way, he's almost the hero of this movie.
Yeah.
Because all he's doing is fighting for his life.
Yeah, these guys just really want to survive.
A moral compass when he was set out, when he was let out into the world. So, and he's not indiscriminately killing. He's killing exactly to survive, or he kills Tyrell out of mixed feelings, but it's not for joy. It's not a thrill kill or anything like that. And at the end of the arc, he appreciates life. He seems to sort of realize in his dying moments that it's something to be cherished, right? Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, we have Deckard popping off replicants, and he has to learn the value of human life because he's not fighting for his until the end, right? So it's an interesting sort of, there's no clear protagonist, no clear antagonist in this when you really look at it, because both on different paths to the same sort of realization maybe, but it's And your instinct immediately is Deckard is the protagonist, obviously, and Roy's the bad guy. But you realize that that's not really the way it
is. If I was watching this movie and I was a robot, I would absolutely see it the other way.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, one other very small point towards the Decker could be a replicant is he drinks out of a square whiskey glass and he drinks out of the corner. No human being would do. That's weird.
How would you drink out of the side of a square glass?
You pour
that's stupid. It's going to drip down the sides of your mouth, you moron.
Well, you pour very slowly out of a square glass. He's sipping whiskey.
Can we
whiskey
get here. Alternate universe Craig back? Can we just... Please.
I suppose you pour out of the pan on the flat side too, right? Just so you can get it all over the counter.
Yeah. You need to dump this like grease everywhere. Coverage. Hang on. There we go.
I bet your kitchen's a mess.
Ty, in any of your other versions, you seem to have some pretty in-depth knowledge. I want you to give me the play-by-play of the robot pleasuring herself with the snake. Go.
You've got him flat-footed.
Was that not in one of the other versions?
Not in any of my research.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was Zora, the most disturbing
and the snake,
of all the hunts and kills on Deckard's party.
Seemed like that was good. We got some,
there was some weird stuff. There was some weird stuff in this movie, but I mean, there's a lot of weird stuff that's in there. You know,
I
really like,
guys. I like boobs.
There were some boobs. Could have been more, but that's okay.
definitely.
We'll do better next time.
I really do like the idea of, so Roy, yeah, obviously when you start the movie, he's clearly the bad guy. And I think that might be one of the only 80s trope things, is he looks like he's like a German sort of Aryan bad dude, right?
Blonde bad guy.
Yeah, it's not. It's no mistake. Guy. Yeah, that
he is the leader.
Point to Craig,
Der Führer. My favorite. If you will. My favorite replicant was easily Leon. Man, what the first guy who gets the test, who shoots through the table. Yeah. What a great, spooky, creepy, just well played. He was my favorite replicant by far.
The Void Comp test seems like a pressure situation for anybody, whether you're a replicant or not. Yeah. You do not want to be on the other end of that thing. And they're asking you, you know, what's funny is I actually briefly considered writing one of these tests and administering it to one of you on this podcast with sound effects and everything else. But I think it would make you uncomfortable.
I'm uncomfortable just thinking about it.
Yeah, they're asking empathy questions for the most part, and what's great is you cannot tell. Again, we're not answering anything here. There's no indication on the part of Harrison Ford's character of what's being considered a good answer or a bad answer. You don't really get the full picture of how this test actually even works. They're focused in on the eye. And they're asking questions about, you see a turtle on his back in the hot sun, he's baking out there, what do you do? And like, what? Like, because you want to answer it right. And you're thinking, what would I do? What is the right answer? Why would this be a question in this test? It seems like the right thing to do would be to flip him over. Yeah, maybe give him some water, take him home. But at some point, you're given a wrong answer there. Or it's just your reaction to the answer, like physiologically or whatever, that's the problem. I don't know, but they don't explain it. But which is what makes the test, when you're watching it being given, which makes it so nerve-wracking, is that you have no idea what's actually happening for the poor person getting the test.
The only assumption I made was that John Voight actually came up with the test. As part
after
of the
reading Mein Kampf.
Yes.
That's why it's called a really weird set of circumstances.
More world building.
Yeah, really in deep depth stuff. Yeah, we'll go right to the sort of the last scenes of the film because we've already touched on it. And there's a couple of lines in here. We're down to the last Nexus Six artificial person. Deckard's taken out all three after figuring out where the first one was, and then.
Well, I actually got help from Rachel in taking out Leon, which was a very interesting turn that I didn't see coming, that she helped him off another robot, knowing that she's a robot.
Well, you know what though? I mean, I think that still works. I don't see any conflict there because humans kill.
I don't either.
Humans.
It was just unexpected. It was just unexpected that a robot would, it kind of shows that again, that she is maybe above and beyond because she was still able to make the choice. It wasn't just, she didn't join the group and try to protect herself. We only know of four replicants up to this point, plus her. The other four have all decided it's all for one and one for all. We all need to protect each other and figure out how we can live forever. And whereas she is decidedly on the other team because of her attachment to Decker. Right. So in that way, she has differentiated herself from the other four.
Every one of them, all four Nexus models plus Rachel are capable of way more empathy at the beginning of this than any human character is, which is, I think, really one of the bigger points of the movie is what makes a person, right? And, you know, later they elaborate on that in the sequel, which is awesome in a respectful way. And it's just, you know, it's part of what's meant to turn you around on realizing what's actually happening here is this is sort of like a genocide. Mm-hmm. And Deckard is willing participant in it until only the end. Deckard doesn't even get the choice to kill Roy at the end. Roy's got him pretty much dead to rights and saves his life. We've got two of the great lines that I always remember this movie for at the end of this. Roy's essentially playing with him and scaring him and chasing him down. And you're sort of thinking, you know, especially if you watch it the first time, that Deckard is going to get the better of him and kill him probably. That's not what happens. Roy gets the better of him and then spares his life. And again, that's the last display of empathy. That's the thing that makes him more human than Deckard at the end, right? Yeah.
Well, it doesn't even spare his life. He saves his life.
Yeah, sorry. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. There's two lines here. Let me see. I think this is... Nope, that's not it. That's not the one.
Is that from the snake scene? What happened?
Yeah, no, that's the deleted scene.
Yeah. I'm coming. Okay, so this line is given to Deckard when he's hanging on for dear life at the edge of a building, and Roy's in a position to just let him go if he wants.
Quite an experience to live in fear, isn't it? That's what it is to be a slave.
Hard hitting watching this. In 2020 for me. I don't want to get too deep. Okay.
Oh man, where are we going?
But that is so, so crucial to stuff that's going on because everyone is unsure of what's happening. And to me, the context I got out of it in this viewing was just sort of realizing, man, every time I turn on the news, every time I look at a news site or get something off of some media, it's somebody trying to scare me at the end of the day, if you really distill it down to what it really is, right?
Yep.
That's what
yep.
the news has become. Well, that's absolutely. What politics has become. And I'm not taking a side on either of that. I
sure.
If you want to look at it politically, both sides are super guilty of this. It's how they operate now. I'll be accused of sounding stupid here, but that line hit me harder than it ever has. And it just made me think, you know, it's time to cut a lot of this crap out. Because if I feel like if somebody's trying to scare me when I'm watching the news, or if I'm listening to a politician, mm-hmm. that's when it's time to stop listening. Mm-hmm. And if you get anything out of this movie in 2020, that's what you should get out of it. Is November, we did Remembrance Day. We do it every year. A lot of people died for you to be free. So don't cheapen it by letting yourself be afraid every day when you turn on TV. Live your life and let it be. It's a great line. It stands the test of time. It's what will make this movie, to me, timeless. I'll watch it over and over again. It's a hard hitter. Did you guys catch it? Did you get?
Oh yeah. No, it was a terrific line. And that really, I think that line specifically kind of brought Roy's arc and made it the most profound one of the whole story. And mm-hmm. like, I think he came out, I know we're not doing winners and losers yet, but I think even though he died, he came out as the dude, because he highlighted a thing that we haven't really seen. And I haven't seen, I should say, in other sci-fi. buy stuff, like, because I'm we recently got Disney Plus and we're tearing up all the Star Wars stuff, right? And there's very few droids that die, and when they die, they usually get put back together and it's hilarious and goofy, but we never really see them die with the finality that we see Roy die with. And yeah, him calling out the fact that, you know, he has more humanity in him than pretty much every other robot I've seen so far. So I thought it was a terrific line that really made him the crown jewel of this thing.
I think he learned the appreciation. Taya said, you know, what makes a person, and they get into that in the next one. And we kind of keep tying life to people and not robots. But if we just think of life as self-aware existence, Roy understood life better than anybody else in this movie. Mm-hmm. And kind of had the appreciation really based on its impending loss. Right. Like, he knew that his time was almost up. And I mean, you hear about people who become ill and their eyes are opened to the appreciation of life that a lot of other people don't get to experience. And it sucks that some people need that, but to take that step. But I think that's kind of what he experienced, and it makes sense. And yeah, I mean, I totally agree with everything Ty said too about the news. I picked up zero of that from this movie, but I've been on that rant with some family members for about the last 3 months with the way the world is right now, where, you know, you will find your flavor of news that will keep you enraged and engaged, but you don't need to. There's no benefit, and your level of awareness of that thing that's supposed to keep you enraged is not going to make your life any better or put you any closer to fixing it. Being happy, though, will. So if by all means, if this is the message you take out of this thing and you want to step away from all that bullshit, by all means, do it. It's the best thing you could do. Step away from all that bullshit, because it's just there to make you mad. I agree 100% with everything Ty said. I think that's the most profound thing we've ever said on this podcast, and I hope everybody takes that advice to heart.
And it's a sad thing to realize in the film for Roy that he's spent his short existence in this state, right? But then when he saves Deckard, lifts him up off the perch he's hanging off of and sits him down, and he's been turning gray for the last several minutes, and you know he's about to go. He delivers this monologue, which some have said is one of the best in film history. All those monologues exist in context on its own, as I'm about to play it for you. It's, you know, it is what it is, but in the context of what is happening, it is a beautiful moment. It's, to me, this is the one I appreciated from the first time I watched it. I didn't really get an appreciation of the "to live in fear is to be a slave" line until later. But this monologue, which was partially written by the actor himself, may he rest in peace. I don't have the audio drop anymore. He passed away in 2019. He partially wrote this dialogue. In the script, it was much longer. And the night before filming it, condensed it and fixed it up. And Ridley Scott liked what he did. And it ended up being what it is. But
Rutger Hauer.
Yes, yes. Thank you.
It's the gentleman's name.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Ten Hauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain.
It's, whoa, get goosebumps just listening to that.
No, I mean, it really does encapsulate so much. It covers the reason that they were built, essentially, and grown, or whatever the hell they were, to be shipped off somewhere and do horrific things. But, you know, just the fact that he's seen things that no human has, I mean, that's it's all dying so quickly with him.
And he's spending the last moments of his life reflecting on things that he's seen, that he obviously has some reverence for, so that he appreciated some beauty there. And it's just like, And Deckard's looking at him with this dumbstruck look, Harrison Ford look, which I absolutely love. Like he's realizing that what he's been doing is fucking terrible.
Horrific, yeah.
you know what I mean?
And again, the worst thing in this universe is that humans made slave laborers with feelings. Why in the world would you do that? It's just the most bonkers Hitler-esque thing I could possibly imagine for anyone to do.
Because we've been referring to them as robots, which I wanted not to do, and we ended up doing it. It's not my fault, but because that's how they present it. That's how they want you to think of them, especially at the beginning, right? And the novel that's based on, which I tried to get to at least in audio form before we did this podcast, but I couldn't do it. And I've committed to myself that I'm going to get to it. Maybe one of you have read it. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is the book. And it's from I believe the 60s, so it's way ahead of its time. That's the whole point of the movie, I think, is that these guys, maybe they couldn't build a human being without feelings. So the way around it was to give the shell of a human memories to make it more agreeable, or if they wanted a combat unit or a pleasure unit or a worker unit, memories that sort of facilitated that kind of work. And so what they're really making are people. They're making slaves out of human beings. But because they're not born, they see them as sort of soulless androids. When in fact, they're human beings like you and me, but with memories that were put there by someone else. But they have to deal with all the same emotions, all the same things. And Deckard is sort of realizing this in that moment. And obviously, the Nexus units themselves, they already knew that. They've lived their lives as people. The memories weren't theirs, but they still sort of are what they are as a combination of what they remember but what also is happening to them in that moment or that time, right? At the end of their 4-year lifespans, for whatever reason, they decided to break away and try and live a life. At the beginning, they didn't, but at the end, they did. So, you know, it says a lot. If you're willing to look for it, it's all there, right?
And it's funny, Ty. I just pulled it up as you were talking because you said you were hoping we weren't going to use the word robot, and I don't really know where it came from. And I immediately thought back to the text of the prologue. So I pulled it up on my screen and looked here. But the very first thing it says is that replicants are bioengineered humans. It doesn't say that they're robots.
Right.
I think almost everything else though that they say about them is very, like, they use the word manufactured in here.
Exactly. Cause I think society is sort of a mechanism to accept the reality of this, believes they're robots or is sort of raised to think of them that way.
Yeah.
And so the society that these things exist in sees them as less than human or as robots or as machines and when I saw this as a teenager, I just thought they were machines. Like, I didn't even think beyond it, right? But they're clearly just people.
It's almost funny / disturbing how easy it was to fall into robot talk, right? Because they didn't do that. I mean, they showed them as a different type of life form that was clearly created by man. And because of that, man, humans are the creators of it, it's so much easier to think of them as less than, right? And I guess that's a scary side of this that I never really clicked into as I was watching it. I mean, it was just like them versus us. But as I started to get towards the end of the story, and I know we already hashed over this, was Aryan guys. What's his name again?
Roy?
Gary. Rutger Howard? That was my mom's ex-boyfriend. Sorry, that was Gary. Roy. Seeing Roy be the main person in the movie who has a full appreciation for life, regardless of its source. He's the first person to have that, you know, epiphany or realization this movie, the more we dig into it, the more I appreciate it. And I'm glad we did this.
It's so fresh.
So fresh, man.
All right.
So
well, fresh. That's Blade Runner, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you guys liked watching that. And I'm glad we did an episode on it. One of my favorite movies of all time.
Nice.
Now we got to move on to what we are going to do for the next episode.
Have we totally canceled Winners and Losers? I don't have them ready, but
I think it's clear.
Okay.
A lot of losers, a lot of winners, a lot of winners and losers. But what are we doing? Which one of you two is going to take it?
This dummy over here is going to do it. And We're gonna keep some things in theme. It's gonna be a strong movie. This is also a movie of the 80s, and I was just looking at the Rotten Tomatoes score, and this movie's gonna be available if you have Disney Plus. Not all the folks, but a lot of folks do have that these days, and happens that all the hosts of this show do. So we're gonna pull a movie from there. This one,
so screw you, people.
Yeah, to hell with all you poor people. This this one scored 84% of an audience score, and then the critic score for this one is actually higher than the critic score for Blade Runner. The Blade Runner was a 90% critic score. This one is a 97.
This is obviously a better movie. What are we watching,
dude? Well, we're going to find out when we watch Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yes! Oh, this is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
This is, Dan, it's funny because I also, that was the other DVD. I wore it out. Mom's Ex-Boyfriends. I wore out Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I would watch it every Saturday morning when I was over at their place because I'd always wake up first and have to throw some movies in. Who Framed Roger Rabbit? I tried to show my son Matthew Who Framed Roger Rabbit earlier this week. I hadn't seen it in years. And my wife immediately stormed in the room and said, "What are you doing? This is not an appropriate movie." And I think she was right.
She may have been. She may have been. Well, I can't
find
wait
out next week. So it's it's Roger Rabbit on Disney Plus.
Disney Plus. Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
And that's going to wrap it up for the episode, folks. Hit us up an email at thecorntigers@gmail.com. We're also available to shout at on the Instas at the Corn Tigers. Music in this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod, sounds from Blade Runner, and also Zapsplat.com.
Used without permission.
Oh, the Blade Runner sounds?
Yeah.
No, that's under fair use.
Use. We're good.
This is a review, right?
I think so.
Let's call it a review.
Sure.
9 out of 10.
I'll give them a 10 if it means they're not going to sue us.
All right. We'll see you next time, everybody. Thanks for tuning in.
Bye, friends.
Have a great
Thanks, night. Guys. Have a good one.